Hey, audience. Hi. I'm really glad you returned. I'm surprised that you returned, to be honest, after what happened last time. I think you know what happened last time. You remember, don't you? I certainly do. It hurt how things ended, but you know, I'm glad that everything is now water under the bridge, or as my troll friend says, a flood. Oh, that made me smile so hard. I want to start this episode with some wonderful intro music from our man Jason. And go! We are all influenced by others, but rarely do we stop to think about just how much our actions are dictated by the actions of others. We've all heard of subliminal persuasion. Red means anger, blue means Walmart. But what we've recently learned here at Go Local is that there's more governing our everyday interactions with people than we thought. We read Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert B. Cialdini, and it was originally published in 1984, but the lessons to be gleaned from it, specifically how to recognize and avoid being influenced by people, are still very much appropriate today. Timeless. Perhaps even more so in the world of incessant social liking, favoriting, following, and Tindering. Probably. Those weapons of influence are reciprocation, commitment and consistency, social proof, liking, authority, and scarcity. And we'll go through each one of those here in a bit. Before we get into that, allow me to pose three questions and then subsequently answer those questions, as I did in our first episode. So if you've heard this already, skip ahead 10 seconds or so. What are you listening to? You're listening to a podcast about marketing and also not about marketing. We like to keep the net very wide on that. Who are we? We're a group of coworkers with a shared love of marketing, specifically as it relates to search engine optimization, user experience, copywriting, content marketing, social media marketing, lots of cool stuff there. I'm Caleb Ross. I'm the senior product manager of SEO. Anna Chandler is an SEO specialist. Jason Barrett is the CEO of this company. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, wow. Huh. He obviously doesn't have a lot to do. Nothing. Taking time out for us. Nothing. Here. Appreciate it, Jason, very
this.
Much.
This is fun.
We've also got Stephen Mott, who is a marketing coordinator.
Bum, bum, bum.
And so who are you? This is my third of the three questions, if you're keeping track. You are someone who's interested in marketing, either as a professional marketing person, a hobbyist, or even a business owner interested in the subject of marketing. It. Or a podcast. Disclaimer, the opinions expressed here in this podcast are not necessarily reflective of those of our employer. So if we offend you, please don't get us fired.
Hi, Jason.
Hello. Can I also have opinions that are expressly not my own?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Corporations aren't people.
They are. Did you check the
Supreme
Court?
Dang it.
Did you guys know that an opinion without pie is just an onion?
Did you know that a joke without laughs is not a joke?
That could be, but people did laugh, so joke's on you, Caleb.
Did you know that a pony is not a baby horse?
I seriously just learned that like 2 weeks ago. I always thought that they were just
small horses.
Is it not a baby horse?
No.
No, wait, that's a colt.
Yeah.
Okay, so a pony is what, a small horse?
It's just like a different like breed or type of them.
Huh. My wife tells me a reindeer is an actual animal. I said it's a caribou. She looked it up. It's true. It's an actual animal.
Oh, wow.
In Europe, they call it a reindeer.
We're going to leave that in because it proves that. I can leave that in.
It proves that CEOs are people, too. Yeah.
All right, let's start off by talking about reciprocation. The quote from the book that I really like is, we go out of our way to not look like moochers. That's basically the heart of reciprocation. And what we'll learn probably through a lot of these is that all of these weapons of influence seem to be versions of either A, other people are doing it, so I want to do it too, or B, someone's telling me to do it, and therefore I should probably do it. All six of them kind of fit into that mold, which is, I think, really interesting if we could distill it down to those two little nuggets here. But the first, reciprocation. Let's talk a little bit about it. The general idea being that if someone gives us something or we receive something, we feel obligated to give back. Let's start by asking, what are the dangers and benefits of reciprocation? I'll start with Anna.
Well, I think, I mean, in general, doing onto others as they have done onto you is a good thing. But you see the dangers in that, though, you shouldn't feel obligated just because they gave you something to give it something back. You know, in the case of this book, it wasn't a friend loaning you a pencil so next week you help them out when they forgot their notebook. It was, you know, people coming by and giving you a small free thing. So shouldn't, therefore, you buy lots and lots of products from them for a large expense that you weren't really planning for?
As a consumer, from the consumer standpoint, do you feel like consumers do have this obligation? I feel as though, and this is just totally observational, that the plethora of free stuff is so much that you're almost getting bombarded by it, and you already recognize that you're being given something free because of the expectation.
Yes and no. These examples are pretty out of date, and if someone came by and was like, hey, do you want some free Tupperware? I'd be like, no, please leave my door right now. On the other hand, with social media, I think that's a very strong influence. You know, if I see a friend has liked my last 5 posts, when they post something really boring about like their breakfast skillet, I feel like I should like it, even though I don't really, because I'm not being a good friend.
It's actually one of the best ways to get new likes or get new followers is to give first. And then the reciprocation follows.
And it's interesting, though, in that specific example, the algorithms are becoming so tight that it's sometimes difficult even just to reach out with that offering of something free. Even those get weeded out. And so there's other signals that govern what it is that you can even then push to other people, yeah. Which is really interesting.
They did a test where, and I think I mentioned this as we were reviewing this book, where there was a table set up on a college campus with free $100 bills. And because people are so used to being taken advantage of due to the reciprocation concept, they could hardly give away the stacks of $100 bills. Everybody thought there had to be something to what was being given away. They thought there had to be a string attached, and therefore nobody was willing to take the $100 bills.
Well, I think in all fairness, that is a logical reaction to someone giving away something so crazy. If it was a quarter or a nickel, yeah, sure. Okay, give me a quarter, a nickel, whatever. There's not any string attached to that. But something like $100, it makes sense that you would.
That's ramen for 3 months.
that's a lot of ramen. Or you could just eat one $100 bill. Didn't think about that, did you?
I did not.
And that really shows the scale of things as well. You know, a like on social media is really, really easy to do. It doesn't really mean much to a lot of people except a quick show of admiration. Whereas $100 is a much larger thing to most people. And you're more weary of greater offers than something simple like a like or a comment.
I think that this is one of the reasons Twitter recently changed their concept of favoriting. They used to have favoriting and now they just have hearting, I think they call it, which is essentially a like. My theory is that people felt if they favorited something, it occupied a certain tier of preference. Whereas a like is, I can like anything and everything. So I think they changed that, honestly, to get more information from users and to factor into the algorithm.
It's either that or they're rolling out like a 12-month Lucky Charm program, and next month it's going to be Shamrocks.
Ooh, I can't wait till Shamrock month. Why wouldn't they save that till March?
Yeah, I guess it does make better sense. That's okay. Why you're the person in charge of our team.
Because I think of the good cereal-based correlations.
Is hearting a word?
No.
Hearting?
And if it is, do you say it? You've got to be really careful how you say that.
Yeah, you do. Well, you either have to be careful how you say it, or you have to be careful
the context,
the company in which you say it.
Yeah.
Because there are going to be certain people.
Things
who are
getting hearted around here, you know.
Yeah, it's that sounds. I think that sounds like something that would actually catch on, honestly enough.
Yeah.
Someone hearting something. Just saying.
They take it to heart.
You could hit Twitter with a billy club. And you would be Tanya Harding them.
Oh, Lord.
Is that a reference, people?
No.
I got it.
How old are you?
Can you cut?
78.
I think I asked that question last podcast, too. That's like our theme.
The bigger question is, how would you hit Twitter? How come no one's asking that question?
You can hit their servers.
You could, I guess.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
DDoS attack?
Apology accepted.
Bam.
All right, let's go on.
I think reciprocation is helpful as an agency because, you know, we're coming to people with genuine things they can take. And we're not obligating them to give back, but it helps build into that social principle. And this is, you know, the good thing about reciprocation is a genuine part of any kind of healthy relationship. So we come with them with some knowledge. You know, we have this expertise. We've noticed these problems. Can we help you fix them? And even if you don't want us to fix them, here's a list of the exact things to do with some other agency that can help you with it.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes a long way to show our expertise and our true passion for wanting to help out clients. We're not trying to sell them something they don't need. You know, that's always been something that I've really tried hard to make sure the agency sticks to. If we can't help them, if we can't service them, then we're not going to pretend that we can. And that's really, really important to me. And so it could potentially at some point, it hasn't happened yet, but it could get to a point where we almost become offended when people don't respond to our outreach of saying, hey, this is wrong, because we want so badly to show them we're being genuine here. That you really do have these problems. But then again, marketing managers on client sides get inundated with emails and with information from people. So it's tough to break through that crowd with a truly generous offering, but it's been working for us so far. Let's talk about commitment and consistency. A quote from the book, consistency provides us with reasonable and gainful orientation to the world. I really like this one, and let's follow the same pattern that we did last time and talk about the benefits and maybe some of the unbenefits to this. Is that a?
Yes, totally a word.
All right, great. Great. We'll talk about the unbenefits first.
The concept of commitment, I think, is important here because it's, once people commit to a concept or an idea or a path, then they want to believe that they've made the right decision, so therefore they stick with that decision. So it reinforces the fact that they're on the right path. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
I think it's also part of the identity building.
Right.
You know, I say I'm a good person because I do this thing. Well, I'm going to keep doing this thing because I want to keep being a good person.
Yep.
It one of the examples they use in the book multiple times actually is the idea of a simple contract of signing something, and not a contract in the sense that there's money involved, but just a simple pledge, I guess. People signing their names to pledges for seemingly mundane, innocuous things, but the truth is that even just writing your name, stating that you adhere to a certain belief or opinion, forces that to become part of your identity, as you both were saying earlier. And it's never, I've always thought it very strange, you know, when you're walking down the street and someone asks for money for a cause and you say, sorry, I don't have any cash on me. But they say, okay, well, can you at least just sign your name, join this pledge? Sure, that's fine. That's the equivalent of basically Facebook liking at that point. But it does feed into, I guess, how you would look at the world afterwards, after you sign your name on that thing and you feel like you're kind of a part of something and you've committed to something and you've got to maintain that commitment.
And I think you don't really want to look bad from people too, especially for a new group. You don't want to seem like you're going against everyone, because then you'll be alienated yourself. So going with something is, you know, a personal thing to make sure that you're not standing out too much, so you don't become an outlier or anything like that.
Right, right.
Like, sign this paper to help protect puppies because only puppy killers wouldn't.
But then you look at our society as a whole, and commitment and consistency are championed, you know, and that was something that we mentioned as we were reviewing the book. You talk about, you know, 50-year anniversaries in relationships. You talk about commitments in a career, you know, how long somebody's been with a company or how long a company's been in existence, period. So there's a real social layer there that champions commitment.
That's been something that I feel is probably one of the unbenefits, if I will, of commitment, is that people aren't allowed to change their minds or opinions based on new information. And you see this all the time with politics. Someone could have made a stance, a politician could have made a stance 2 decades ago about something. And if they're running for office, that's going to be brought up. Their current view on things is going to be held to that initial stance. And the idea is that they're not allowed to bring on new information or take on new information in order to change their perspective on a particular topic. And that's always seemed, you know, politics is the easiest the easiest example of that, but it happens in other places too. And that's always seemed to me as something, a bit of a bad thing, that to not encourage people to learn more and grow more and have different opinions or change their opinions in any way. So,
and there's a big difference between, are you committed to and are you constant in your underlying beliefs as a person, or are you committed to a fact that you learned 2 decades ago, which quite naturally could be out of date by now?
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, I think in a lot of national stage situations, it's the latter. It's a specific fact. You know, at one time it was a fact that the earth was flat, you know, at one time it was a fact that pandas weren't going to go extinct. But we all know now that they are.
It's kind of
sorry, panda listeners, but
yeah, it's kind of the panda's own fault though.
That's true.
Let's be
honest.
True. I'm sorry.
This is one of those where, though, they were talking in the book about how if you can get small concessions, you know, not to talk about manipulation and whatnot, but they were using it with Chinese prisoner of war camps, POW camps, and getting just small commitments. Like, we're not asking you to say that you love communism. We're just saying, can't you agree that it's another way to look at the world? Fine. It's another way to look at the world. And then they just keep building. And consistency bred commitment. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that they mentioned in the book, is if you could get consistent movement along a path again, then you could finally get that commitment to, you know, get somebody to stand behind what they've already decided.
And yeah, and not to compare marketing agencies to communism, but I think, you know, it plays into a role in the terms of our commitment to and constancy in relationship with clients. You know, they see us, they see the same person every month, checking in on them, reporting on the health of their website, asking questions, giving feedback. And so when that 13th month rolls around and it's time to make a new decision, well, are you going to go on this brand new path of questions, or are you going to stick to someone that you know and trust?
Right. Yeah. I think that's important too, because you mentioned it a little bit, Jason, that a lot of these weapons of influence may initially come across as though they are predatory in nature, is that you're trying to manipulate someone.
They are called weapons.
They are called weapons.
In your word.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And not my word. It's Chialdini's Chialdini's words.
Chialdini's words.
It says psychology right there.
But it says weapons of influence many times.
Okay.
In the book.
Here's the thing. Okay. They can be used for good. They can be used for evil.
That's very true.
So we're making
it's all,
sure.
It's the welder of the weapon that determines. Actually, no weapon by nature is a bad thing.
That's so we.
Well, like a knife you use for cooking.
But it's not a weapon if you're using it for cooking, right?
Is it not?
No.
I think
you're murdering
you mean,
bread.
I think what you mean if? Wielder and not welder.
No welder. The person who puts the knives together.
Yeah, like it's not really on like, them, right?
If they don't put the knife together very well, it's going to break off in someone's sternum and there's infection.
The knife on a perfectly live chicken.
Then it wouldn't be a weapon, I don't think.
It's a weapon to that chicken. You are
chicken.
A chickenist.
He is. And apparently a hater of pandas.
As the world is.
What animal don't you hate?
That's a good question. I'll get back to you on that.
Tune in to episode 3.
Maybe. I don't know.
We've lost everyone by that point, except our parents, siblings.
The point I was going to make, it's not all vindictive. It's not all intentionally misleading. It's the natural way of a person interacting with someone that ultimately leads them to these ends of commitment and consistency. So, for example, the person on the street corner asking for signatures, they may have a quota of signatures they have to meet, sure. But at the same time, they're also engaging with the public in a way that they're trying to understand and possibly hear what people are saying, and trying to create some sort of community around that small interaction, and that then leads to some commitment and consistency eventually. Now, that might be the minority situation there, but I like to believe in the good of humanity, so I'm going to continue to do so.
Do you?
Most humanity.
Thank you.
3/4 of this room, I do believe in. Let's.
Dang it.
Sorry, Anna.
No, it's totally me.
It's you.
It's all you, I guess. Weapon of influence, numero tres. Social proof, which I think of as the canned laughter approach. You see this in sitcoms, much like that. You see this in sitcoms on TV all the time. There's people who laugh at the jokes, and it's basically to allow you to... You want to be a part of the laughter. You want to be part of the fun. Basically, our actions are more correct, quote-unquote, if others are doing it.
There is enough here that you can use for good. You know, in my opinion, this is really where SEO and Google in particular got its start. And social proof is, to me, Google's version of their linking algorithm. And the inbound links, not only how many are there, but who are they from? And so it's good to see that. I always use the book example that if Caleb recommends a book, that's great to know. But if Oprah recommends a book, it's a bestseller immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's something about that social proof that everybody can get behind and understand. And in this case, it's actually can be used for a good thing. Now, people can link build, buy links, you know, mess with the algorithm. And knowing that this is the way it's built and taking advantage of it. But there's still something there to the fact that everybody looks at social proof for simplifying the way to understand the world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's something that I wanted to say on several of these is these are all shortcuts for people that make it to where they don't have to think too much and we can just react. And this is one of those examples here where if enough people say they like a book, we think, fine, let's read it. You know, or if everybody says this is a great movie, like Star Wars is coming out here in a couple weeks and it's supposed to be a fantastic movie, we'll load up the theaters to go see it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just something to that where we don't have to dig through Rotten Tomatoes. You know, there's something there that if enough people say it's good, we'll go see it.
Yeah, what classic example, I was scrolling through Facebook the other day and a friend of mine had posted the comment, it's over, and there's 23 likes. And so I liked it too. The thing is, without those likes, do they mean like their relationship? Like, did they have cancer? It could be awful.
Right.
But with that many people liking, I assume they're like, oh, they finished their term paper or whatever.
Don't you also look to see who liked it?
Mm-hmm.
I do that. Like if there's enough likes, then you go, okay, yeah, that's a pretty good count. But I'm curious to know who, because I don't want to follow the wrong herd of people and look like I'm one of them. You know, so I want to make sure that
nor
I'm
are
with
they
the
you.
Right group. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. So it's interesting.
And we can show that in marketing all the time, too, by going to a prospective client saying, here, your competitors are using this, even though these big names are also using these services as well. You don't want to, you know, be left behind basically in the dust compared to everyone else. So by doing what you're doing, you're staying current with everyone and even, you know, beating out some other companies as well. So I think that's a big part in gathering prospects from a marketing base as well.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side of that, I think when we can show someone the dangers of something that a lot of people like, that gives us an enormous amount of credibility. For example, Yext. A lot of people aren't aware of the drawbacks, though, so they go heads first into it. When they find out from us, you can keep going in this direction, but here are the things to be aware of. They realize, wow, you know, so many people give a yes. So if these people are giving a no for these solid reasons, mm-hmm. they must really know their stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that gives us the opportunity, too, to show that not always is the, you know, the company like Yext that has the most, you know, notoriety the best choice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's then our opportunity to prove why we're better than someone that's more well known than us.
This whole conversation really bled. And I think during our conversations about the book, this happened as well. But the idea of social proof and liking sort of congealed during this conversation. And I realized that I just started by saying that the conversations bled together, and now I said congealed. And so, you know, I'm
gross. You're gross.
This is the Necrotic Podcast. I'm your host.
No.
Undertaker and DJ.
Okay, can you stop beating the dead horse and get back to it? Thank you. Horses is another animal that Caleb doesn't like.
Oh, well, if they're dead, they're fine. And the idea of liking, which in the book is treated as a separate social, a separate weapon of influence, like I said, it folds into social proof pretty easily, because a lot of social proof is created by people collectively saying that they like something. A quote from the book is that we prefer to say yes to the requests of someone we know and like. So again, they're very, very similar. I'm not sure if it's worth delving in or discussing liking specifically, since we kind of tackled both of those all at once. So I will move on to the next one. The fifth and penultimate weapon of influence is authority. The primary example, and I think I can describe this one by way of example, is with the Milgram study. It was a study in which participants were asked to shock a fellow human being with electricity.
Not with vivid descriptions of disgusting scenarios.
So the test subject was asked to shock another person who was involved in the study if they weren't able to provide memorized answers sufficiently quickly. And anytime they made a mistake, they were asked by the lab assistant to increase the severity of the shock. And the shock dial went up from mild to moderate to severe to XXX, which was like the death level. And some people were happy to keep pushing that button. Most balked. And they sweated. They were nervous. They were saying, I can't possibly do this. We have to stop. Look at this person in pain. Because they saw this person in the room, you know, writhing and screaming. But whenever the person in the lab coat said, no, you have to keep doing it, they just did. Almost every single person went through the entire experiment.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few people who didn't, actually. Milgram had actually asked his fellow professors before the study, you know, how many people do you think are going to go all the way? And they said, almost none. Like, 90% of people are going to stop. That's ridiculous. That's evil. And in fact, the findings were the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
They did further studies after that where they removed some of the authority. So the person was no longer in the white lab coat, the doctor telling them to go on. And then most people did in fact stop. But just that one person who seemingly had the right to tell them to do so, they're willing to, as far as they knew, torture someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, the assumption being that if someone of authority, even if I'm not quite sure how they got that authority or what that authority means, just the fact that I am supposed to view them as a figure of authority means that I will listen to what it is that they do. And from a marketing perspective,
We don't necessarily want to shock all of our clients, you know, with electricity
to death.
To death, probably not. But I think it's our obligation to not just say that we're the authorities on certain subjects, but to prove that we're the authority on subjects, so that they know that when we tell them to do something, shock people, that they can.
This is a bad analogy.
It really is. It really is.
Let's just stop and do a new segue.
As an agency, you know, our white lab coats are our knowledge in the industry and our experience going forward with it as well. So that's what gives us the credibility factor among prospective clients or current clients as well, to show what we can really do for them.
Well, in the case studies as well. I mean, our presentations, the branding initiatives that we're going through. I mean, all of that does. Those are the visual elements that support what it is that we can do.
And I think that's the important difference. Don't shock someone, even if they're wearing a white lab coat, just FYI, guys. At the same time, if you have someone who's an actual doctor and saying like, hey, this medical treatment of chemotherapy is going to hurt, but it's worth it, here's why. Well, now you have the reasons to go through with this. In the same way, we're saying here's what we need to invest, here's the time we need, here's what we're going to do, and here's why. So not just authority do this, but the motivation and the reasoning behind it.
I think to Caleb's point, the ability to show the performance and the outcome of the suggestion helps us gain the authority for the next time, so that they can believe and trust in us when we do say something that might seem a little far out there or something that maybe they hadn't thought of before that doesn't seem quite right. You know, they know that we've proven ourselves in the past and should be able to do that again. So
I think another important point is to say when we're not the authority. Right. Like, I get questions about SEO and they'll say like, well, what about this PPC budget? And I'm like, that's a great question, but let me ask a PPC expert because they know better.
Right.
Or they'll say, well, what is Google's next algorithm update? I don't know. I have some guesses, but they're just guesses. Google's not going to tell us that beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to not seem use too technical terms or try to seem like you were much smarter than the other person. You have to explain it, you know, really bring it down to their terms as well, because that gives credibility not only as a numbers person, but also someone who can really help you out personally.
One thing I wanted to note and a perspective I've tried to bring along through each of these is, as our client, they can utilize these same weapons or levers of influence to market to their own customers. And so when they want to seem like an authority in their particular area of expertise, then they need to show Better Business Bureau labels on their website, or the HTTPS secure socket layer for e-commerce sites, or signals of trust and signals of authority as they try to build that up for their own clientele. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's one of those things where if I hire somebody to come out and do pest control at my house, it would seem like they should show up with, you know, a truck, with a tank, with, you know, some sort of a jumpsuit looking out, you know, that sort of thing. You're anticipating a certain type of person showing up. Same thing with, you know, anything else. If I'm on an e-commerce site, I'm hoping that there's a cart. You know, I'm hoping I can view my items in the cart. I'm hoping there's shipping options. I'm hoping that I get a confirmation that the order was received. I'm hoping I get a confirmation the order was shipped. So as we work with our clients to establish new businesses or new channels for doing business just like this, you have to set up these signals to show that you're legit and that you actually are an authority in your own particular arena.
Right. If you're a brick and mortar store, you want a clean, well organized, well lit, you know, lots of great things in the store. For an online website, you want to make it very built out, very easy to use, great user experience. Because for a lot of people, that's the first interaction they'll have with a business, rather than, you know, going just walking into a random store. Their first interaction will be on a social page, on a local listing, or on your website itself.
Lastly, weapon of influence number 6.
Why do you call it weapon?
Scarcity. Think of scarcity as just a limited number of something. If something is limited,
supply and demand.
Thank you.
Just think of scarcity as dictionary definition of scarcity.
Think of scarcity.
That was a Caleb.
That way.
Yeah, good job.
It's not Caleb's usage of vocabulary.
I don't know what that means.
You have a word count that can go a little high at times. It's not a big deal.
That's true.
It's not a big deal.
I edit your blogs. So.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Scarcity.
So scarcity is obviously the idea that something is scarce, the supply and demand, as Jason said. And so if something is of a limited quantity, you feel more driven to acquire that thing. That's sort of a very specific example, but this idea works a lot of ways with like limited time offers, coupons, that sort of thing. Groupon has built basically an entire platform off of combining scarcity with liking and social proof.
Amazon has scarcity at a genius level. You know, when I'm shopping on Amazon, I'll tend to put the item in my basket a few days to make sure I really need it. Also, pro tip, if you put an item in your basket on Amazon but do not purchase it and then go to another site that uses retargeting banners like Facebook, you'll often see a discount coupon for the item that's waiting for you, and then you save money on your final purchase. But anyway, when I'm on Amazon, sometimes they have those daily deals where, you know, the object, there's only 300 of them and they're only available for the next 20 minutes. Well, I can't just put it in my cart. If I want it, I have to get it then. And sometimes I get things because I'm like, oh, this is a really good deal. And then like when I get it in the mail 2 days later, I'm like, I did not need this much coffee. This was a silly thing to do.
And I think that going along with that is if you're at a store and you look at a certain item or certain type of item and there's three options, you'll probably go with the one that there's least available because you'll assume that that's the most popular one, mm-hmm. and therefore the best one as well.
And that's where I touched earlier when I mentioned that a lot of these elements overlap. I gave the earlier example with Groupon, but also if in regards to scarcity, if there's only a few left, that implies that brings in the social proof aspect. Other people have obviously grabbed it, this product, and are enjoying it at home right now.
Where it could just be, you know, they were used so often or, you know, bought so often they had to restock them and they don't care about the other one, it's not always the right assumption, but you'll take the chances because that's how you're programmed to believe.
Well, that brings back to Jason's point earlier about these being shortcuts. They're profiling in some way, you know. You're basically buying into a stereotype. You're buying into something that has probably historically been proven accurate in some way. In this case, if there's a lot of a product missing or a lot of product gone off a shelf, then that means that that it's probably well liked by people.
I don't think we use scarcity as an agency tactic. It's not really helpful in the way that, you know, making sure our customers like us and that mm-hmm. we're authorities is. On the other hand, there are genuine scarcities out there, like the scarcity of time. So when we have a lot of clients coming to us who want a new website, we have to make sure that all of those websites can get built out on timelines that work for them, but also for our team. So we can tell them, hey, we would love to do this for you, but we can't get started for another 2 weeks. Is that going to work for you?
Right.
And that, on the other hand, might help them decide, okay, well, if I want this built at a reasonable time, I need to start now.
Yeah. We actually have a lot of clients that have scarcity built into their offerings where you have an e-commerce client, for example, that is literally going to be out of an item, out of stock of an item in a matter of minutes. It can happen, you know, and you can show that stock or inventory online and people can do with that information as they will. The same thing goes with, say, a self-storage client where you're looking to find a storage unit in a facility that's close to your location. And they're 92% occupied. You know, you're looking at, they're down to just a handful of units, and it's up to you whether you want it or not. Are you willing to drive another 5 miles down the road? So there are times when that scarcity is naturally in the marketplace where we leverage it, maybe from a marketing perspective, a bit more weapon-like is when we artificially create scarcity. You know, where the inventory maybe isn't quite out of stock, mm-hmm. but we can show it as if it were, you know, those sorts of things. The Tickle Me Elmo was an example from the book, which I thought was great. They purposely held back the inventory to drive people to buy something else, only to then buy the Elmo later anyway. So they got them to double up their purchase over the long term mm-hmm. versus just buying one item by itself. But there was one thing in this particular section that I wanted to point out, and that is that the optimum is to have newly experienced scarcity. So you literally watch it become scarce in front of your very eyes. And this time of year, we call it Black Friday. You literally can see that mob of people heading into the store, and there are only so many of those TVs or so many of those phones or whatever it is that they're heading into the store to pick out. And you can see all those people ahead of you, and you're watching it. You know that that thing is about to become more scarce, and you want it even more. And it just develops this frenzy, which thankfully I avoid, but there are a bunch of people that do not, you know, and there's something about just seeing it go away that makes you want it more,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they go on to say it's the joy isn't in having the item, it's in, I'm sorry, in experiencing the scarce commodity, it's in possessing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. All you want is to have it. And then when you have it, the joy is probably gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as long as we're, again, using this scarcity concept for the right, for good, you know, making sure our clients or our clients' consumers are informed and that they can make informed decisions, then I think we've done the right thing.
And I think that brings up a great point, Jason. For all of these, there's, you know, the pro side and the con side to them. As a summary of the whole book, you know, the author was discussing how can we avoid these tactics when they are being used in the right way, and not only to avoid, you know, potential suffering, but to preserve them, because these are good things. Social proof and liking is important. So how do we make sure that it stays viable and doesn't get kind of, you know, bought out by greedy marketing, as it were? They specifically, you know, the author was talking about just being aware of them is half of the battle. But I want to see if you guys have anything else to add about how to avoid the shady tactics and then recognize when they are, in fact, in use for good reasons.
I think being aware is important, and I'll just mention it very specifically. It's important because it removes that moral obligation for you to feel bad about dismissing the offer or saying no to the offer. All of these things, I'll use reciprocation as an example, are designed to get you to buy into something on the pretense that someone is being good to you and is offering you something free of charge. And as soon as you realize that, as soon as you make that connection of what they're doing, you no longer feel morally obligated to participate, and therefore it's easy for you to distance yourself from the situation. So that's why recognizing it works so well, I think.
But watch how the crowd behaves to you backing off of one of these principles. It's just it's crazy how it is. You come across as very cynical and like somebody who's just like tough to get along with, you know, and unfortunately you're aware of the situation, but your behavior is so counter to the culture that you stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's unfortunate, but that actually happens. I've seen it over and over again, because I like to think I'm aware of some of these tactics myself, but when you point them out to other people, they don't even want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, hey, you know, they're just trying to give you a flower, man. You can't take a flower, you know, or the Hare Krishnas of the olden days. But, you know, there's if you're aware that there's something behind it, you know, you do your best to avoid it, but you're going to look different than everybody else, unfortunately.
I think it's important to step back and kind of see a more holistic view of an argument like this. If you're buying a car for half off, yes, you're saving money because it's half off, or you'd save the most money and not buy the car at all.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Putting a monetary value on that is different than, you know, stepping back and saying, hey, this is probably going to be the best decision in the long run, and that it really shouldn't matter if this is half off or scarce or anything like that as well.
Yeah, that's an argument I use for my wife all the time when she finds things on sale. I saved 50% on this today. Well, you could have saved 100% if you just didn't buy it.
You sound like me.
Which is interesting, because I think women as a whole are a lot more aware of the reciprocation principle than men are. You know, if a guy buys a random girl a drink in a bar and she says no, all of her friends are like, yeah, that was a good move. But if you buy a drink for a guy in the bar, they will never say no, not ever. It doesn't matter if you're wearing like an actual trash bag and you have like a monster mask on, they never say no.
Nope.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But that probably feeds into other motivations, because even outside the bar, just in general life, you know, if someone is offered something by a girl, a guy is offered something by a girl, it's you're gonna say yes to it.
It
doesn't matter. I mean, it could be anything.
I mean, it is free beer, even if it's from a monster mask.
As a man who is constantly getting offered free beverages by women, I feel, you know, often, you know, the need to pay him back somehow and engage in sort of conversation or, you know, social networking of some sort. But, you know, at some point it's just too much, and I have to say, you know, I'm really sorry. As much as I would love this, I will not be able to repay you at all, so I will accept this without any other further interaction. And unfortunately, I hate to do it, but
no, I totally understand.
For everyone listening, his face was straight the entire time.
It was. I almost believe it.
Very good.
This explains all those old ladies hanging around outside your car all the time.
It's weird you're single.
Hey, attractiveness has no age.
Oh my gosh. On that note, I think it's probably time we close out this episode. I want to thank everyone for sticking through it. Really appreciate it. Please tell your friends all about the Go Local podcast. Use some of those social proof and those liking weapons of influence. That was my echo. Head over to golocalinteractive.com to read the show notes for this episode. Also, be sure to subscribe to this podcast, please. You can use the RSS feed link that you'll find at golocalinteractive.com. You can also find us on iTunes, and possibly if Google ever gets their pod out of their cast, we will be in the Google Play Music Store as well. That actually should be forthcoming here very shortly. And until next time, remember, if all your friends jumped off a bridge, then it's probably cool if you do too.
It's probably on fire. Or because you're dead and snapped your neck from jumping off a bridge.
See there.
Or because you're being chased by women trying to buy you a drink.
That's a very good point.
Ba-dum.